As of tonight, we will have studied 36 lessons of the life of David, and we will not be really all the way finished until we get over into a few chapters in 1 Kings. And so we will plan to continue this series for two or three more weeks, Lord willing, and it should work out to where it ends up just about at the end of the year. We're having a good time with this. I know at least two of us are. That's why I say we. And so it's been a very interesting series of lessons, and one that I have enjoyed tremendously because it has opened my eyes, as always happens. It's really opened my eyes to some things that I hadn't really thought very deeply about before, and I hope that it's had that effect for you as well. 2 Samuel chapter 24, this is a very, very interesting chapter because it deals with something that, again, we're not completely satisfied with what we know here. In other words, the text leaves us with a lingering question or two that we just simply don't have the answer to, but at the very least, it gives us some really, really important lessons to consider that apply to us today. The first verse is a little bit controversial because it says there, I'm reading from the New American Standard Version, "Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah." Now, if you're using the English Standard Version, you'll notice a really stark difference there. The English Standard Version is in harmony with the New Century Version, the English, the Living Bible, the New English Bible, and several others, and they word that first verse as though God gave a commandment to David saying, "Go number Israel." It's always been a controversial subject, and it's important for us to realize that even aside from however this is properly translated, it is a true fact that often things happened that God was said to have done, but actually it was something that God allowed to happen. Now, I'm not saying that that's the case here. God certainly allowed it to happen. But I'm a little at odds with the translators of the English Standard Version, which is, at least they claim to be, one of the most accurate word-for-word renditions of the text that is available. And yet I don't understand this. I don't see this as being accurately portraying God giving the command to go and number Israel. Additionally, if we compare this text to the parallel version in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, there the text says, "And Satan moved David to number Israel." Well, there's no questioning that. There is no doubt as to what that is saying. And if we consider the fact that we have that parallel account which gives that explanation, in the second place, if we consider the fact that God will never command His people to do something and then punish them so dreadfully for doing that very thing, I'm confident that 1 Chronicles chapter 21 is the more proper rendition of this particular text, where it says, "And Satan moved David to number Israel." But still, the question comes out, why? Why did David do this? If you read the entire chapter, and I assume most of us have at least sometime or other in our Bible study, or if you've pondered over it for the last few days like I have, you are aware of the fact that several things in this story come together and provide a better understanding of what's going on. We know for sure, for reading here, that what David did was wrong. We know for sure that David came to the conclusion himself that he had committed a terrible sin in doing this. In the third place, it was even acknowledged by Joab that this was a terrible thing to do and that it should not be done, and really a surprising position for Joab to have taken. And so there's no question that what was done was wrong, was sinful. Why would David do something like this? There have been all kinds of explanations offered. Some have said perhaps David was ready to expand his kingdom and overtake some of his neighbors, and God might not have been willing. Or maybe David just felt like he was going to do it without bothering God about this thing, and so he needed to know what size an army he could raise. Suppose that could be a plausible explanation. Some have said that perhaps it was just purely the sin of pride, where David, just for no specific reason other than the glory of the knowledge of the strength of his army, could know the size of it. I've got another idea. It's very, very rare that in a difficult Bible passage I come to a conclusion apart from everybody else. You know, most all of the good ideas have already been had before I came onto the scene. But I've looked at this way. You'll notice it says, "Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel." Perhaps this situation, and we're given no real indication of exactly when this occurred during the reign of David. Perhaps this situation fits chronologically just a couple of chapters back, right on the heels of two revolts against God and God's king. First of all, Absalom. And then scarcely had the rebellion been put down that Absalom led, that Sheba arose to lead another rebellion against King David. Perhaps then this takes place just after that second revolt, and perhaps God's anger with Israel burns against them because of the fact that now they have on two occasions, very close together, rebelled against him and the leader that he has approved. And also in view of all this, perhaps at the same time, King David, in a moment of human weakness, looks back at what has just happened, first with his son, secondly with Sheba, and he thinks to himself, "You know, if this happens a third time, I might need to know how everybody stands and how many people we've got, how many there are in Israel, remember, the rebellion of Sheba, it was mostly Israel against Judah." And so maybe, just perhaps, David says, "We've had two, we could have another one. I've been the ruler a long time. Maybe there are a significant number of folks who are ready to take over. And so if this happens a third time, I'd like to know how many men there are of military age and ability in this kingdom." And so you have my idea. That's just another idea. Perhaps plausible, perhaps not. I'm not sure. But at any rate, the decision was made to count the people, to count the apparently the men who were of the age to be able to wield a sword. David said, "Go number Israel and Judah." To Joab, he said, "Go about now through all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and register the people that I may know the number of the people." Verse 3, "But Joab said to the king, 'Now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are while the eyes of my Lord the king still see.'" The writer of 1 Chronicles chapter 21 puts it this way. He said, "May the king live long enough that the people have multiplied to be 100 times greater than they are now. But why does my Lord the king delight in this thing? King David, why are you so hung up on the idea of counting the people?" Nevertheless, verse 4, "The word of the king prevailed against Joab and against the commanders of the army." Notice there that it's not just Joab. It's Joab and all of the commanders of the army who are taking God's side on this thing. So Joab and the commanders went out from the presence of the king to register the people of Israel. It tells where all they went, and basically it's summed up in the phrase or the expression from Dan to Beersheba, which means from one end to the other, top to bottom, all the way. And it took 9 months and 20 days. And if you read 1 Chronicles chapter 21, you'll find out that Joab took it upon himself to make the decision not to even include the tribes of Levi and the territory of Benjamin, because this thing seemed to him to be such a bad idea. 9 months and 20 days. And the total, according to the writer of 2 Samuel, was 800,000 men in Israel and 500,000 in Judah. In 1790, the first U.S. census was taken. It required 217 people 9 months to count the 3,929,000 and some few hundred Americans in 1790. Interestingly, the counting of the people was something that took place throughout Bible history from time to time. And it was never just a blanket situation that was wrong. In Exodus and Numbers, it was connected and associated with the collecting of a tax from all of those who were counted. No mention of a tax here. Our government, even today, uses the census as a very important benchmark to make certain decisions. I suppose maybe a good thing, maybe not. No matter what it is that our government does, rest assured there'll be many who are satisfied with it, many who are opposed to it, and then the most of the rest of us are kind of in the middle and we just sort of don't care. If you read 1 Chronicles chapter 21, you will find that there is a different number that has been arrived at from this number. 1 Chronicles 21 verse 5 says, "In Israel there were 1,100,000, and in Judah there were 470,000. This is one of the three cases in this chapter where there is a conflict with a number as opposed to the number that's given by the writer of 1 Chronicles 21. Last Sunday night, I made some comments that may not have been completely understood, and I want to clarify them Someone reminded me that I had made a real important point about the word-for-word accuracy of the inspiration of the Bible. And then I immediately turned and talked about some of the controversy where we don't know for sure which number was really right when we read these two accounts. Let me clarify that. In fact, I want to share a quote with you. The commentator, Adam Clark. He says, although the original writers of the Old Testament were under the influence of the divine spirit, yet we are not told that the same influence descended on all copiers of their words so as absolutely to prevent them from making mistakes. The Bible is divinely inspired, word for word, absolutely accurate. But once the original writers wrote the words down, hundreds, yea, even thousands of people were involved in making copies of it by hand. Many of the Hebrew numerical characters are a little bit similar, and particularly in small form, and as the ravages of time affected manuscripts, numbers, even more so than words, have turned out to be hard to distinguish sometimes. For example, a 3 and a 7 in Hebrew are very similar. And so as the copyist copied these books, these writings, sometimes, and especially in the case of Numbers, there was a mistake made. And when one copyist makes a mistake, and then three or four copyists down the line make another mistake with the same letter or the same number, then the mistakes just kind of multiply. There's the problem with what is called a corrupted text. The problem is in the copyist who reproduced the manuscripts, not with the word-for-word inspiration that delivered the words to begin with, but then the question comes up, well, how do we know, and how do we know when it doesn't matter? Well, there isn't a single case in the Bible where a controversy involves something that is a matter of salvation, right and wrong. There is not a single case where enough evidence is not included in other parallel passages to reach a reasonable conclusion. This particular verse that I call your attention to, this is one of the three. There are three verses in this chapter that are referred to by commentators as corrupt. And it's simply because there is a conflicting number in 1 Chronicles chapter 21, and nobody knows for absolute certainty which number is correct. Put your hand up. Right.
And so somebody may have had the account of Joab, and somebody had the account, a different account. Both accounts would be right, but from different sources.
Okay, that's a good explanation, an interesting fact that perhaps in 1 Chronicles they knew what Joab's records were when he left off certain ones and added that to it and came up with a larger number. So at any rate, again, there's not a controversy over anything that involves the question of right and wrong. Now, David's heart troubled him, verse 10, after he had numbered the people. In fact, David became so bothered by this thing that he approached the Lord and he said, Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have acted foolishly. And when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, Go and speak to David. Thus the Lord says, I'm offering you three things. Choose for yourself one of them, which I will do to you. Now, when God says, what I will do to you, he's not talking about David personally. He's talking about the nation of Israel, God's people collectively. And he said, here are the three options. Gad told David, first of all, he said, shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Now, here's the second occasion where we're in conflict with 1 Chronicles 21. 1 Chronicles 21 says 3 years of famine. Says three here? Okay. Some of the translations have changed it to match 1 Chronicles 21. Three seems to be the more reasonable number when you especially consider this. 3 years of famine, or will you flee 3 months from your enemies while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days of pestilence? 3 years, 3 months, or 3 days? And David's conclusion to Gad was, I'm in great distress. Let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great, but do not let me fall into the hand of man. In other words, David says, don't want the war. I don't want the famine. We'll take the disease. 3 days. There have been a lot of folks who've really questioned how in the world David could make a decision like this. A couple of things are real important. One is, we know the end result. David didn't. I don't suppose David had foreknowledge of the fact that there would be 70,000 men who would be struck down by the disease in 3 days. Secondly, some have suggested that David's answer was a very selfish thing. I disagree. Because you see, if David had chosen the 3 years of famine, his wealth would have fed him and his family fine for 3 years. If he had chosen 3 months of war, David would not have gone to the battlefield. He, as the king, would have been protected in the palace. But in choosing 3 days of disease, David had no shield. He was a man, and his family members were just like everyone else in the kingdom, and so he was subjecting himself and his family to the same thing everybody else would be subjected to. He had no way to know whether he would be stricken by the disease or whether members of his families would. So I don't believe it was a selfish request. And so the Lord sent the pestilence upon Israel from the morning until the appointed time, and 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. When the angel stretched out his hand toward Jerusalem to destroy it, the Lord relented from the calamity and said to the angel who destroyed the people, it is enough, now relax your hand. The angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Araunah, the Jebusite. David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking down the people, and he said, Behold, it is I who have sinned. It is I who have done wrong, but these sheep, what have they done? Please let your hand be against me and against my father's house. And so Gad came to David on that day and said to him, Go up and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. And David went up according to the word of Gad. And Araunah came down and saw the king and his servants. went out and bowed his face to the ground before the king. Araunah said, "Why has my lord the king come to his servant?" And David said, "To buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord, that the plague may be held back from the people." Araunah said to David, "Let my lord the king take and offer up what is good in his sight. Look, the oxen for the burnt offering, the threshing sledges, the yokes for the oxen, the wood, everything, O king, Araunah gives to the king." And Araunah said to the king, "May the Lord your God accept you." However, the king said to Araunah, "No, but I will surely buy it from you for a price, for I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing." So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. There's the third occasion where there's conflict with 1 Chronicles 21, which says 600 shekels of gold by weight. Some have offered the suggestion that since the Temple of Solomon was built on this particular site, perhaps the price in 1 Chronicles 21 was the price for the entire place. The price here in 1 Samuel 24 is the price for just the threshing floor and the oxen. Again, this question doesn't have to be settled in order to have an understanding of this story. David built there the altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. Again, we perhaps don't even have a sufficient answer as to why David decided to do this in the first place. A lot of things aren't really clear, but we are told enough to observe some things that are very important. Let me share those with you as we conclude. Number one, there is no substitute for the balance of sufficiency. I would encourage you to jot down this passage, Proverbs chapter 30, verses 8 and 9. Here's what Solomon said as he neared the end of his life, or neared the apparently the end. He said, "Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I not be full and deny you and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God." We need to keep everything in the right perspective. We need to be satisfied with whatever it is that God blesses us with. We don't need to allow the desire and the lust for riches and worldly goods to cause us to lose our trust in God. Perhaps that's what led David to do what he did. Again, we're not really sure what it was. Number two, reflection and contemplation are conducive to repentance. We see that illustrated in verse 10, where it says that after Joab and the men had counted all of Israel and come up with the total, then David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. Have you ever had someone say to you, "I wish you'd think about what you did," or "I wish you'd think about what you said"? Now, we don't need to brood over things unnecessarily, but there are certainly a lot of occasions in our lives when we need to give some additional thought to maybe something that we've done or something we've said to someone. And sometimes that additional thought may be the difference in arriving at the conclusion to repent and to make things right. Number three, there is always a price for sin. you'll notice that David approached God and he said, "Forgive me, because this is an awful thing that I've done." God didn't say, "That's okay, son. Go ahead. Everything will be all right." There was a price that had to be paid. It seems almost like an unfair price when you consider that 70,000 people died. But I want to suggest that in verse 1 of this chapter, there's rolled up in there some information that we may not have, and we don't understand really why the Lord was moved with anger against Israel. Perhaps it was the rebellion or those things that had taken place. But the fact is, God saw fit that 70,000 people should have to die because of what had been done. That same rule is still in place today. Whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. In the ultimate sense, Jesus has paid the price for our sins, but in an earthly sense, there are always consequences physically for the transgressions against God's will. And then the fourth thing that I want to share with you is there at the end of that story. A sacrifice isn't a sacrifice if it's free. Remember, wasn't it last Sunday night that we read about the occasion when David poured out that precious water that had been brought to him at the risk of his men's lives from the well of Bethlehem after he expressed a desire for it? He wouldn't drink it, but he poured it out to the Lord as a sacrifice. Sacrifice is taking something that's precious, something that's really important to us, and giving it to the Lord. David states a principle here: I will not offer that to the Lord which cost me nothing, because it really wouldn't be a sacrifice. It wouldn't be a proper offering. Lord willing, for the next couple of weeks, as I said, we'll go a little further in the story of David. He lasts on another chapter or two into 1 Kings, and in fact, there is some interesting information that takes place after David's death that ties in very closely to what we've already studied, and so we'll include that too. But right now, if you're subject to the Lord's invitation, we sing this song to encourage you and invite you to respond as we stand and sing.